I just want to share with you some remarkable survey results just published online. And thanks to Muslim Skeptic for bringing it to everyone's attention. The survey is the Arab Youth Survey, and it's now in its 14th year, it says. And the annual Arab Youth Survey is the largest study of its kind of the Arab world's largest demographic. It's over 200 million youth. And I just want to share with you a few of these slides and to make a few comments and the implications for the rest of the world, because they are quite remarkable, I think. So just scrolling down here and looking at this slide, it says the largest independent survey of its kind among young Arabs. 3,400 face-to-face interviews happened across 50 cities in 17 Arab states, interviewing people between the ages of 18 and 24, 50-50 split between male and female. And the survey was conducted from May to June of this year. So it's a very recent survey. And they covered 17 Arab states in three regions, an area they've entitled GCC, which basically covers Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And then another area, region called the Levant, which covers Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, Syria and Yemen, and North Africa, another region covering Algeria, Egypt, Libya, Morocco, Sudan and Tunisia. So vast areas of the Arabic world they've covered. And they did, as I say, these face-to-face interviews in about 50 Arab cities. Now, they've split their findings into six key themes. We're just going to look at one of them, actually. The first one, my identity, the views of young Arabs on religion and their concerns about the loss of traditional values and so on. And I just want to focus on a few of these slides, as I said. So my identity is the first big theme that they surveyed. And they put a little headline here, religion, they say. The survey compilers have concluded religion is central to the personal identity of young Arabs, yet they want religious institutions to reform. It's very interesting. So this is the first survey. Sorry, this is the first slide here. Very interesting. Young Arabs view their religion as most important to their personal identity. And you can see from this graph, a range of possible personal identities that might be really important, whether it be gender or their language, their political beliefs, their Arabic heritage, their family or tribe, their nationality, or their religion. And you can see here on the far right there, gender is the most important for their personal identity, just for 5% of people. And that's consistent over the 2 years survey, 2021 and 2021 and 2022. My language, Arabic, is important, really important, just another 5%. Political beliefs, 6-7%, no change really over the years. The Arabic heritage is actually gone down in significance from 10% last year to 7%. And then their family, their tribe, last year, it was really important to a quarter, or 21%, nearly a quarter, has gone down to 17%. Their nationality, whether they are Saudi Arabian or Bahraini or Kuwaiti, Iraqi, whatever, is very important to just 18%. And that was the same last year as well as this year. No change there. But when we come to their religion, last year, 34% stated that it was most important to their personal identity. This year, it's shot up to 41%. Now, that's a 7% increase. And as the Muslim Skeptic article commented very briefly, a 7% increase in just 1 year, with the Arab youth numbering over 200 million, says a huge amount regarding the significant dynamics at play, quote unquote. What's interesting here is, though, it doesn't tell you what the religion is, because although most Arabs, of course, are Muslims, some aren't, particularly in the Levant area, maybe in Lebanon, for example, which is a very multi-faith society. But so we're not necessarily looking at an equal increase, say, from Christian increase in the significance for their personal identity along with Muslim. There may be, you know, different dynamics when you break those stats down. But for me, the most surprising and, dare I say, most encouraging survey results are these two. And let me just scroll down here. And it says here that nearly three quarters of young Arabs are concerned about the loss of traditional values and culture. And they were asked, how concerned would you say you are about the loss of traditional values and culture? And going back over the years, it goes back, as you can perhaps see from this slide, 2018, it was 70%. The following year, it was 72%. Last year, it was 70%. Probably pretty much stable over the years. Nearly three quarters think are concerned about the loss. You compare that with at least my subjective impression of many of the youth, say, in the West, who have certainly abandoned many traditional values and embraced new woke ideologies and lifestyles with gusto, it seems. But the young Arabs, who are overwhelmingly Muslim, they're not all Muslim, because obviously they're Christians and others, seem to be very concerned about that. And for me, of Islamically, I think that is an encouraging, healthy sign of you know, clinging to those traditional values which reflect the common good. And perhaps lastly, and this is perhaps most controversially, and I think for Western policymakers, commentators, dare I say, governments, is this survey, which I've kept to last. This is still within the My Identity theme. There are many other survey results. I'm not going to go into them here. You can look at the slides for yourself. I do encourage you to have a look at a huge range of statistics to chew on. But this one says a majority of young Arabs say the laws in their country should be based on Sharia. The question was asked, which of the following is closer to your point of view? The laws of my country should be based on Sharia / Islamic law, or the laws of my country should be based on civil / common law. And the majority, 56% of Arab youth, said that the laws of their country should be based on Islamic law, and only 44% said no. Now, that's remarkable in itself, and I'm sure that would be of some concern for some Western governments and policymakers who are perhaps hoping that secularization or liberalization or globalization would diminish the Muslims' attachment to divine law or God's law or Islamic law, Sharia. Clearly, that's not the case. And we're dealing here with young people, not older people who might be expected to be more traditional. But when we break down the statistics a little bit more, it gets interesting. When you look at the three smaller categories, GCC and North Africa and Levant, we get some very interesting breakdown. In North Africa, which is predominantly Muslim, 60% wanted their society's laws to be based on Sharia. And then you go just on the right there, is only 41% of the people in Levant. Now, why is this big drop only 41%? And 59% actually want common / civil law. And I think, I mean, I don't know, but I would guess it's because there are many Christians living in that area, the Levant. I mentioned Lebanon already, and obviously there are Christian groups and minorities in Jordan and other places in that area. And I think that's probably why you get that figure there. And then you get in the GCC area, looking at the Gulf, looking at Bahrain and so on, and you get a whopping great big 70% wanting the laws of their country to be based on Sharia or Islamic law, as it's also understood. So fascinating. If you equalize it out, you get 56% majority. So what is it about Sharia? Because in the West, of course, we have a very negative portrait, a very negative vibe about Sharia, and it's associated with chopping hands and all sorts of things, because it's not what Sharia is about, but that's how it's perceived. So why are Arab youth very predominantly attracted to this? And part of the answer for a Westerner, you know, how do we explain this to a Western non-Muslim audience. What's the attraction of this, of Sharia? What is it really about? And I just wanted to share a few words from this book, of course, often quoted from it, Islam and the Destiny of Man by Guy Eaton. And he was an English convert to Islam. He was a Muslim, I think, of over 50 years at the time of his death, several years ago. And he was a consultant at Regent's Park Mosque in London, where I go. And but above all, I think he was a superb writer, and he has touched the hearts of countless Westerners who have ultimately embraced Islam because of the way he has expressed Islam to a Western audience so they can understand. So he was like bilingual. He could speak Islam and he could speak Western, if you like. He was fluent, or had a thoroughly conversant with both worlds, and was able to explain one to the other and vice versa. In chapter 9, I just want to read just a few paragraphs of this book, Islam and the Destiny of Man. He talks briefly about Sharia, or Islamic law. I'm not going to read the whole thing. There's a lot more that could be said. I'm not in any way pretending what I'm going to say now is in any way definitive or exhaustive. It's not. But it just gives a little bit of a flavour of how a Westerner might express the appeal and the logic and the profundity of the Islamic perception of society and law and God's sovereignty, because it's quite different from the secular one. So chapter 9 is entitled The Rule of Law, and Guy Eaton writes the following, and he was writing in the 1990s, so some of it might sound a little bit dated. During the period of decolonization in the 1950s and early 1960s, the question as to which territories were or were not fit for self-government was seriously debated. No one raised the more fundamental question as to whether any nation on earth is fit for self-government. Then, as now, the Swiss were said to manage their affairs competently, and Costa Rica was well spoken of. But elsewhere, it was difficult then, and remains difficult today, to suggest any model which a newly created national entity might reasonably seek to imitate. One is obliged to ask whether there may not be something basically unworkable in the very concept of government as the term is currently understood. In the past, the tribal system, functioning like an extended family, may have come as close to perfection as any human society can hope to come, not only in ancient Arabia, but also in Africa before the slave trade, in North America before the coming of the white man, in Central Asia and in the Pacific Islands. But wherever mass societies emerged, requiring systematic organization, government was, until recently, accepted along with plague, famine, and taxation as among the unavoidable evils to which fallen humanity is exposed. Acceptance of a necessary evil, however, does not imply any willingness to see it grow and expand. The aim must always be to reduce it to a minimum. But minimal government requires, as its complement, the self-regulating community, since men and women cannot live reasonably under conditions of anarchy. Such a community can function and endure only within the framework of a revealed or predetermined law, which in effect takes the place occupied by instinct in the life of animals. The Quran, which is the constitution of any truly Islamic community, itself validates this comparison. For it assures us that God has laid down for every species and for every group of living things a law and a way. But whereas the inanimate universe, together with all living creatures unendowed with intellect, is governed by laws inherent in its very structure, man, precisely because he possesses intellect and a relatively free will, is required to follow the law of his own being voluntarily and with understanding. Stones cannot know why they fall, nor birds why they migrate. Man is by definition a knower and by destiny a chooser. But in the Islamic view, he does not have the capacity to make laws for the conduct of society. Now, I'm just going to repeat what Guy Eden has just said in that last verse, in that last sentence, because it's so key. Man is by definition a knower and by destiny a chooser. But in the Islamic view, he does not have the capacity to make laws for the conduct of society. Key insight there. And he continues. The belief that God is the sole legislator flows directly from the Muslim confession of faith, La ilaha illallah, which in this context can be interpreted as meaning that there is no legislator but the legislator. The message embodied in the Quran and the laws derived from it and from the Sunnah of the Prophet bind the community together. No exterior pressure is required to make this binding effective. True sovereignty, says Guy Eaton, resides neither in the ruler, nor in government, nor in a statistical majority. It belongs to God, but is in a certain sense delegated to his rightly guided community. And the law, precisely because it is a reminder of the laws inherent in our own created nature, the fitra, of course, should not, in principle, require the apparatus of the state, officials and policemen to make it effective. Whatever place the contemporary Westerner may give to religion in his personal and social life, this is still only a place. It is seen as one element in the total structure of human life. But it is not itself that totality. For Islam, on the other hand, the social order is a part of the religion and cannot be separated from it. And that's the end of that particular quote. He goes on to talk about the function of the ruler and how it's strictly limited and how Islamic society is theocentric, he says, rather than theocratic, a very important distinction which you'll have to read for yourself on page 178, because this goes on and on and on. But that last sentence, I think, is so important, that for the Westerner, religion may have a place in his personal life, maybe on Sunday morning in church, but it's just one element, Guyton says, in the total structure of a human life. But it's not itself that totality, says Guyton. But for Islam, of course, it's very different. The social order is a part of the religion and cannot be separated from it. So in Islam, there is no secularism. It just doesn't exist. There is no secular space apart from the religion. It is a whole, the whole of society. But it's not a theocracy, as he goes on to explain. There's a common, almost universal misunderstanding in the West. They don't quite understand what Islam is and how it works. But this is from Islam and the Destiny of Man by Guy Eaton. Please do read the whole chapter entitled The Rule of Law if you want to get a much more balanced and holistic understanding of this. So a majority, to come back to our survey, a majority of young Arabs say the laws in their country should be based on Sharia. Well, personally, I'm not surprised because what are the alternatives? It's globalization, it's secularism, which doesn't really give you a reason to live and a reason to die. It doesn't give you an objective moral code. It doesn't give you a way of life. Faith, religion, Islam almost uniquely today, I must say, to say, it was not always the case in the past, but today Islam is all probably unique of the world's major religions in doing that. Other religions have become secularized and have lost that all-encompassing, holistic, social, political, spiritual, theocentric orientation, and now they've been relegated to the private realm. But it seems that certainly for young Arabs, most of them still retain this sense of the centrality of Islam for their lives. And I think for the world we live in, that's good news, in my personal opinion. Till next time.